This is July 22nd, 2021. We are in Bedford, Massachusetts at the Edith Norris Rogers Memorial Veterans Hospital. And this tape is part of the Morse Institute Library's continuing Veterans Oral History Project. My name is Jim Ramsey, and our camera person is Maureen Sullivan. And we are very privileged to have with us today Nicholas Michael Zales. Welcome, Nick.
Thank you.
You're most welcome. May I ask when you were born?
I was born August 16th, 1949.
And where were you born?
Webster, Massachusetts.
Did you grow up in Webster?
Yes, I did. I lived in Webster until I went to college.
I see. So tell us, so you were born in 49.
Right.
So please tell us about your life growing up in Webster.
Well, it was rather interesting times, like 40s, early 50s. We grew up with family, we were fairly poor. Unfortunately, my father, who was a World War II veteran, died when he was 38 years old, leaving my mother and I and my sister to be raised by my mother, who was only 28 years old. And she was the child of an immigrant family, so she was really not that well aware of how everything operated. She didn't even have a driver's license. So that made things a little difficult for us because people came and took advantage of her naivety. And in my father's case, he was a very prominent businessman, invested in a lot of property. And had he survived, we would have been quite affluent.
And you have one sister?
Yes, I do.
Was she younger than you?
She's about a year and a half younger than me.
I see. And did you go to the public schools in
yes.
Webster?
Yes, I went to the public schools. As a matter of fact, my first school was made in 1832. It was Thompson School. And we went to different schools at that time. One of the things that I noticed that was a little different than nowadays, we had desks that were bolted to the floor with an open top and an inkwell. And I definitely remember us doing air raid drills under our desks.
Ah, the old Cold War
yes.
time.
Yes. So I can even remember most of my teachers from back way then. And we lived probably about a mile and a half from the school. So I would take my bicycle to school every day.
I see. Was the Cold War a fairly kind of prominent topic or sort of in the background? Or?
No, as a matter of fact, it was pretty much in the foreground due to the fact that everybody was worried about building bomb shelters. Hmm. And I do remember the Bay of Pigs, and I remember the Cuban Missile Crisis. I remember those. I was old enough.
Well, yep. Well, that was a unique time.
It was stressful times because people didn't know what to do. Everybody had plans for the air vents out of the ground when you built an underground shelter. So it was pretty tense.
What is your marital status, Nick?
I'm married. I've been married for 41 years.
What is your wife's name?
Her name is Maria.
And do you have children?
Yes, I have one daughter. She's 30 years old, and she is a critical and emergency care veterinarian.
And what is her name?
Her name is Alexis.
And do you have any grandchildren?
No, my daughter will be getting married next month.
Well, congratulations
Thank
to you.
You
and to her. And so moving now toward, you grew up in Webster.
Yes.
You went to the through the school system there.
Correct, public school.
Public schools. And now we come to when you are, 17 or 18 years old?
Correct.
And you entered the military.
Yes.
When and why?
Well, it was interesting at the time as because this was during the very peak Vietnam period. We all had registered to the draft. We were all issued draft cards, which I still have mine. And
so this was 69?
Yes.
Okay.
So I went to my local draft ward and they said, in a month, if you don't enlist, then you'll be drafted in either the U.S. Marine Corps or U.S. Army. You can take your pick. And I thought at the time that as a sole surviving son and the last person with my name, they were providing some type of exemption if they're non-combat roles, but it didn't seem to work out that way for me. So I wound up on 20th January 1970 enlisting in the 267th Communications Squadron, the Massachusetts Air National Guard.
Massachusetts Air National Guard.
That's correct.
And I think we can say at this point, just by way of overview, that your wonderful career spanned almost 40 years.
Yes.
And all of that was spent either in the National Guard or the Reserves.
That's correct.
Air Force and Army.
And Army, yes.
And of course, all during that time, you were holding down a civilian job.
Correct.
Or jobs.
Yes.
I believe, Nick, that you're the first person in this project, Natick Veterans Oral History Project, to have basically served his entire military career in the Reserves or the National Guard.
Okay.
And I would hasten to say that of that 40 years, you told me that about 13 of that counted as active duty time because of the need for your active duty service.
Correct.
So, congratulations on that.
Thank you.
What must be close to a record-breaking career in many ways.
In a few more months, I would have crossed five decades of military service.
Whoa. Why, by the way, did you choose the Air National Guard to start?
I had, at the time, graduated from Wentworth Institute with associates in electronic engineering, and they were really looking for people with electronic aptitude in order to fulfill the needs within their unit. So they enlisted me and they sent me to Lackland Air Force Base for basic training and then on to Keesler Air Force Base for ground radio equipment repairman school.
So you'd gotten a degree or you got some training at least in
yes.
In electronics?
Yes. I had a 2-year associate's degree.
Associate's degree. And so electronics communications was kind of your bag.
Yes.
Tell us what basic training was like at Lackland. Was that fun?
Well, fun would be a rather acute term to say it. I want to say that up until that point, when I was in high school, I wasn't a very good student. I was an average student because I didn't have a father figure to kind of guide me. I kind of ran amok a little bit. And when I went to basic training, they certainly straightened me out, put me on the right path. And basic training was very interesting. I think a few of the interesting portions were, at the time, Vietnam was really, our troops were heavily engaged, and we had a hospital called Wolford Hall at Lackland Air Force Base. And because we were next to the basic training base, there was potentially a pretty unlimited amount of supply for blood donor for those having critical injuries from Vietnam.
Wow.
So what they did was one day they said, all right, any flight that volunteers to give blood today will have the afternoon off for training and we're going to give you steak dinner. So as usual, us being naive said, sure, we'll go. So they marched us to another side of the base. They said, go in that room over there and just stand in line. What they'd done was brought in all the people learning for the first time how to draw blood for the medics. So we had people screaming, passing out. My arm was all black and blue because they punched through the vein. And then at the end of the event, the drill sergeant said, well, forget the training, we're going back to training, no steak dinner. And away we went. Another time.
Welcome to the Air National Air Force.
No, well, welcome to the military, because I'm sure they did all those things, whatever service branch you were in. Another particularly noteworthy item was when we got our shots initially, they put them in a pneumatic gun. So they said, walk here, take two steps, stop, wait, and then take two steps, stop, wait. So they gave you a gun with one shot in each arm. I think they probably gave us about 10 shots all at once.
You were a captive audience.
Absolutely. We didn't have much to say about it. You just did what you were told.
Did what you were told. Okay, so after basic training of 6 weeks or so, or what, a couple of months?
Yeah, 6 weeks.
You went to Keesler Air Force Base for specialized training.
Right. That was my military specialty, ground radio equipment and communications. And I graduated from there and returned back to my unit so that I could fill a gap that they didn't have.
And when you were doing both kinds of training, I assume you were in there with active duty people as well as other National Guard, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So you finished your training, and your civilian job at the time, by the way, was what?
At the time, I was working for Cambridge Thermionic Corporation.
And this was in the communications, electronics area?
Yes, I was a technician.
A technician. And you basically, we don't need to dwell on this, but as I understand it, through really much of your military career, you, of course, were doing civilian work in that same general field.
Generally, yes. Then later on, I graduated into the program and project management disciplines.
Right. You increasing responsibility.
Yes, that's correct.
In your civilian life, where you really spent the majority of your time.
Correct.
Okay, so after training, you came back to Massachusetts, and you were with, what was the unit?
The 267th Communications Squadron.
And that was where?
That was in Wellesley, Massachusetts.
Wellesley?
Yes.
And your home at the time, well, currently, you live in Lexington, right?
Yes, I lived in Lexington at that time as well.
Right. So, and basically your requirement there was weekend a month?
And one weekend a month and 2 weeks active duty in the summer.
Okay. So, and you started this in 1970. And what was your rank when you started?
When I started, I was an Airman First Class, two-stripe.
Airman First Class.
Right.
Okay. And what did you do in this unit?
Well, the unit consisted of major communications huts on mobilizers pulled by deuce and a half, so 5-ton trucks, and we would go out to a particular area, set up worldwide communications. Mm. We'd install the antennas, then get the huts cranked up with the generators, and we would communicate.
And was all of this equipment established equipment, or was some of it sort of cutting edge, or?
I think it was cutting edge for the time, because we did UHF, VHF, we could talk to aircraft, and we could do pretty much anything we wanted. They were that well equipped.
By the way, we're talking now about the Massachusetts Air National Guard.
Correct.
Explain a little bit about what the Air National Guard, or what the National Guard is. It's a state unit.
Yeah, the National Guard is actually the governor's militia. The National Guard at the time was unable to be activated unless it had the permission of the governor. So if the active duty decided they wanted to activate the whole unit, they would have to get the permission of the governor, as opposed to a reserve unit. When later I became at Hanscom, I became an individual mobilization augmentee. I was a reservist. However, I was not assigned to a unit. I was assigned to a position in the active duty.
Okay, and we'll get to that in a few minutes. But that, thanks for that explanation. So how many people were in your group in Wellesley?
I would say maybe about 120.
120. And everybody was in the same situation of having a full-time job, but putting in important time in this National Guard unit.
One thing that was unusual at the time, I've kept my hair short my entire military career, and even if I tried to grow my hair long, my daughter would tell me, "Dad, go get a haircut." but in the case over there, in those days, guys generally wore their hair a lot longer, and they were actually allowing people to wear wigs, as long as it met the military specification of not touching your collar, they just looked the other way.
As long as the hair didn't touch the collar.
Yeah. So I thought that was kind of odd. I never had that problem, so I always kept my hair short.
Okay. How long were you with this Air National Guard unit?
7 years.
Seven years.
Over that period of time, I was promoted to E6 Technical Sergeant.
So you started as an E3, did you say? And you worked your way up to E6 Technical Sergeant.
Right.
Okay. What did you like most about this, working with this group?
I think it's the personnel. We had multiple disciplines within the squadron, and we worked with the motor pool, we worked with supply. It was just a good group of people to work with.
And basically, the way it worked, even though you were there for a weekend a month and then 2 weeks in the summer, somebody basically had organized assignments for you to do.
Correct. I worked under generally an E8 or E9, and they would, when I came in for my duty, they'd have things laid out for me that what I had to accomplish, in addition to also completing training requirements.
Ah, so you did training too?
Yes, so we had career development courses that we all had to do. There were remote access, and that they would send you the books, and you'd have to learn them and then take your exams at the unit.
So you would do that kind of stuff during your active duty time?
No, this would be on your own, home at home.
Right. But that would help you advance.
Absolutely. The requirement, unless you had these particular training completed, you could not be promoted to the next grade. And the other thing also what was a requirement was that you had to be in a position of a grade or two higher, so that when the time came and you're having the minimum time of service and time in grade, you are eligible for promotion, assuming that you completed all the requirements.
Right. Well, you obviously did well. You advanced three grades to E6. And so we come to 1977.
Right.
What did you do then?
Well, I really enjoyed being out in the field. We spent a lot of time out there, and we would occasionally do some mock attacks in response to somebody attacking our perimeter. Mm. So I thought I would like to try something just a little bit different. So I transferred over to the Massachusetts Army National Guard to the 972nd Military Police Company, where I became a military police squad leader.
Military police?
Yes.
I see. So why did you, that's an interesting move. What was your thinking, if you can?
Well, I think probably went back to when I was a kid, when we used to like to play Army and then shoot up and play guns. I said, I think I'd like to try something just a little more exciting. So I became a member of that company, and we were pretty much field troops. So we spent all our time always out in the field.
Okay, and that was actually kind of two sort of significant moves. One was Air Force National Guard to Army National Guard.
Yes.
And from communication specialist to
basically
a military policeman.
Right, I had to get qualified in that career field as well. So that was a different set of training that I had to accomplish.
So you, I guess I would say that, from what I know of the rest of your career, that indicates a very broad view and a tremendous range of interests that you have always had.
Yes, I've always liked to be kind of adventurous and want to try different things and learn as much as I could.
So this was in 77 or so that you joined the military police.
Right.
And where was this?
It's the original unit was out of Lexington.
Right. That unit is not more than a mile from where we are right now.
That's right.
Or pretty close.
Yes.
And I've always wondered what it was, so thank you for helping me understand that. So what does a military policeman do?
Well, we're responsible, being a field military policeman, we're responsible for security, out in the field, we would be responsible for convoy escort. If you're escorting a vehicle convoy from one location to another, we would be protecting the convoy as well as leading it.
I see. And were there other, I mean, when we think of, let's compare it to civilian police. Most of us are a little familiar with what civilian police do, which is kind of public safety, keep order. Is there some of that to it too?
There's a very small part of it because we were not, so to speak, garrison military police, where we did traffic control and control on an installation. Ours was to be defensive positions that we'd have to dig to protect whatever resource was on the inside.
So when you were off for maneuvers on a weekend or summer, then you, that would be what you would do?
Yeah, we'd sleep on the ground. We'd go through mock attacks and repulsing attacks.
So did you like camping and such as a kid?
Yeah, I did, actually, I did. I was, when growing up as a teenager, I spent a lot of time in the Webster Dudley Boys Club, and we used to also go out every all summer, and I used to be an assistant counselor, so I'd spend the whole summer out in the woods.
So that was sort of your pre-basic training?
Yes. One interesting thing about that, just to show you how not particularly astute I was, one day we're in the woods, and a couple of campers say, I see a couple of snakes. I said, well, I'll go get them. So we went out with a hatchet. Turned out there were two big water moccasins, and I went after them, and I chopped off their heads. And the counselor said, you know, you could have gotten bitten by these things. And so that was not a bright move on my part.
So you still had something to learn?
Oh, plenty to learn.
Okay, so you were in the Army National Guard.
Right.
You were a military policeman.
Correct.
How long did you do that?
Next? I did that for about 3 years. As a matter of fact, one of the major things we accomplished was I was involved in the rescue operations for the Blizzard of 78.
Oh, you were? And I remember that blizzard.
Yes, it was very interesting. That was a time we got, we were the only military policemen in the state that were authorized to carry sidearms, 45s. And I remember we got a call in the middle of the night saying we're being activated and we're gonna go into Boston. So we were to meet at our armory in Lexington, and because the snow was so bad, I woke up my neighbor and he had a four-wheel drive truck and he drove me to the base. And at that time, our vehicles, we were still using Jeeps. Nobody had, the Humvees were not in use at the time. And we had to drive to Camp Curtis Guild in Wakefield just to pick up our vehicles. And we were a little delayed because the snow was so bad. They needed a front end loader to clean the snow away from the front of the doors so we could get in and open up our vehicles. Huh. So each squad was assigned a separate Jeep, and that's what we drove, Jeeps.
Just for those who may not know, the Blizzard of 78 was a truly historic storm.
Yeah, that's correct.
It basically shut down the Boston area.
Yep, yep.
Route 128 was brought to a standstill.
Well, when we got back to the armory, we formed up. We were told we were going to go into Dorchester and work together in patrolling with the Boston Police Department. Huh. So when we went down there, we came down the Mass Pike. And it was getting kind of heavy for our snows. When we got off at the bottom by the Prudential Center, some of our vehicles bottomed out because the snow was so deep, the Jeeps got stuck. So we eventually went into Dorchester, and at the time, there were no preparations for us. So we slept for 9 days on the floor of their locker room. We just put out our sleeping bags. We were also short on rations for a few days because they had to try to bring them from the warehouse in Natick all the way into Boston. So that was interesting as well. But most of the things we did there, we rode patrols. We would be involved in quelling any potential riots, arresting looters, and that type of thing.
And again, just to be clear, whenever you did this sort of work, this counted as active duty. Is that correct?
Yeah, we were activated for active duty. We were brought to active duty for this emergency.
Right. So how long did you, about how long did you work, you may have said, for the Massachusetts, for the Army National Guard?
About 3 more years.
Okay. So around 79 or 80.
Right.
So you were still a, or were you a,
Staff.
What was your rank? You were now in the Army. Were you still an E6?
Yes, I was, but that the E6 was a staff sergeant.
Staff sergeant, which is the Army rank equivalent to a tech sergeant.
Correct.
So after that, after your military police work, what did you, just continue in some kind of military capacity?
Well, of course. again, being the adventurous type, I said, I'd like to try something different. One of our advisors for the military police out in the field was that were ex-Special Forces senior NCOs. So I got really interested in listening to what they were about, and I found that they had a Special Forces company in Rhode Island at Camp Camp Fogarty, Rhode Island. So I said, well, let's give that a try. So my sponsor contacted them down there, being an ex-Special Forces trooper, and they said, sure, we'll bring you in. So I joined them and was there for 3 years in Special Forces. And guess what? They needed somebody with radio skills. So the thing that was interesting about that was when we went out and did maneuvers, generally farther distances away from where we were, and we had flyaways to different places, that they said, well, you're a big guy, you can carry the rucksack, you can carry the radio on your back, but we don't want you to feel unbalanced. So they said, here, you can carry this M60 machine gun in the front to kind of balance you out.
Lucky you.
Yes, that was probably the start of my knees going bad.
I see. So, again, this was a a National Guard, Rhode Island National Guard now.
Rhode Island
Army National Guard.
That's correct.
And you were still holding down your civilian job.
That's correct.
But on the weekends and on in the summer,
right,
you were in Special Forces.
Yeah, it was A Company, 2nd Battalion, 19th Special Forces. And these guys were wild. They were, what a crazy bunch of guys. We had a lot of fun.
Now, Special Forces work in teams.
That's correct.
Is that correct?
So they work in 12-man teams.
You were part of a 12-man team.
Right. They assigned us each to one of the A teams.
One of the A teams.
That's what they call them, A teams.
Okay.
12-man teams. Had two officers assigned, and the rest were enlisted personnel, each having two critical career field requirements. In my case, I was primarily communications, but if the small weapons person, something happened to him, my secondary specialty was small weapons.
Does a machine gun count as a small weapon?
Yes.
Okay. Even though it weighed a lot.
It weighed a lot, yeah. But that was a great weapon, though.
Was it? And so you basically, so how did you actually spend your time?
We spent our time down there training. Mostly, in my case, was conducting communications. I had to learn Morse code because that type of equipment was such that you would call, they called a coda burst, and it would send out, you'd type up your message on a Morse code, and then it hit a burst, and it would go out in a very quick pulse, which would be extremely difficult for anyone to intercept.
Oh, so you had to be fast.
Right. There were a number of boxes you put together. They were in small boxes, and you put them together in a field, then set up your antenna.
I see. I see. So you were in, I presume, through all of this, that you were in great physical shape.
Oh, yes. They definitely kept us running. First thing, every drill we went down there, we had to run 3 miles before we even started breakfast.
Three miles every morning.
Yep.
Warm up. And so, I mean, the Special Forces, to say the least, is an elite unit, and I'm sure the National Guard was, or no, this was Army.
Yeah, that's right.
No, this is National Guard still.
That's correct.
Huh. National Guard, Special Forces.
Right. And again, the reserve forces would parallel the active duty side, where if the active duty special forces were to deploy, they would have us deployed to a certain area. And from what I understand, if we had had an all-out war, we would have gone to Mongolia.
Mongolia.
That's where we were going to go.
Wow. So you were on this path with special forces.
Right.
You were with this group for how long?
Three years. 3 years.
And tell a little bit about what happened sort of to cause you to make yet another shift.
Well, I think mostly because of injury. When I went to airborne school up at Fort Devens, 10th Special Forces conducted an airborne training course. And I thought that was kind of interesting, because the main airborne course you would go to get qualified is at Fort Benning. And we didn't have all of the equipment that they would normally have at Fort Benning, but they gave us a condensed version because we were reservists. And I remember normally at Fort Benning, one of the things they teach you is not, you know, to jump, fall, land from different heights to simulate the parachute coming down. And then we'd go out on a long cable and slide down. And when you hit the bottom, you would tuck and roll and so you wouldn't get injured. One of the things they had down there is teach you how to deflate your parachute when inflated when you land. You had to be a certain minimum weight. I can't remember your leg, at least something like about 125, 130 pounds, because if you had landed on your face, the parachute could potentially drag you and you would smother in the ground, because you wouldn't be able to have enough weight to get up and pull the parachute down. So in our case, we didn't have the parachutes to inflate and practice unhooking our harness and rolling away. So what they did was they strapped us to the back of a Jeep and dragged us down the road in the Jeep, and you're bouncing around, and the sergeant would say, okay, unhook. You'd have to clip and roll away from the back of the Jeep.
Huh.
The one thing that injured me, we did a thing called a swing landing trainer, in which case you actually sitting in a harness, maybe about 12 feet up, and you swing back and forth in a pendulum movement, similar to the way you would coming down in a parachute. And and they would swing you up real high. So I was up high in a high arc with my feet in the air and about 12 feet up. And I'm not sure if the guy thought he was funny or played a joke, but he dropped me and landed on my back from that high up. So from then on, I was limping around. It was really hurting. So that's when I started getting back problems.
And that sort of brought your special forces career to a...
Well, yes, I didn't want to have to ask them to give me any special treatment because of that. And then besides, the doctor said you could potentially become paralyzed if you just fell the wrong way.
Right.
So,
wow.
So I said, well, I might as well try to go back to the Air Force where I started my career. And that's how I wound up at Hanscom Air Force Base.
Huh.
But I can tell you, my experience in Special Forces was great. I just loved it. We had a lot of fun. We were wild and crazy guys. I can tell you that. We weren't afraid of anything.
So that, and at that point, let me just see here, you were born around 8. So you were around 30 years, 30 to 35.
30, I was 30.
Still young and yep. A little wild, or maybe a lot wild.
And I'd already had about 10 years of service, so you needed 20 to be able to get a retirement. So I said, well, I'm just going over the hump. I might as well keep going because I'm still having fun.
So it was pretty much a fairly continuous transition?
It was. There was no lapse in service.
Through any of this?
None of it. Straight through all the time.
So you went back to the Air Force, but this time it was the Air Force Reserve.
Correct.
Which was your first reserve assignment.
That's first and only.
Only, right.
Yes, as I was mentioned earlier, we were not part of a reserve unit. There were two categories, Category A and Category B. Category A were actually unit programs with the Air Force Reserve, such as a unit up at Westover Air Force Base. Mm-hmm. That was Category A, where they met once a month, and they were part of the active duty Air Force. So the Air Force did not have to go through a governor to activate them. They just say, I'll pick you up and take you right in. In my case, I was a Category B individual mobilization augmentee, where I had each one of us had a parallel position on the active duty. The premise was that if the active duty got deployed, we would immediately be activated and take over their job at the base we were at.
Individual mobilization augmentee,
correct,
shortened to IMA.
That's right.
And basically, you were, as you told me separately, you were in that type of role for the rest of your career.
That's right.
Okay, okay. And so this was around 82 that you,
yes,
started this?
That's correct.
And just again for reference, thinking forward, you left in 2009, I believe, right? Or retired?
Yes, I retired August 16th, 2009.
So just for reference, that was 27 years in addition to all that you, the 13 or so years before.
Yeah, but I just kept having fun and enjoying it.
You,
and I didn't want to go.
put me in, Coach.
Exactly. Exactly. It was just so interesting, and I believed in my country, and I loved serving in the military.
So you were at Hanscom, which again,
yes,
is right here. Part of Hanscom's in Bedford, part in Concord, Lincoln.
It's pretty much it's a contiguous, it borders Lincoln and Concord and Lexington. So
it's right here.
It's right here.
So you started in 82, and what did you do first?
They put me in security police because I'd had Army military police background. And again, I had to now re-educate myself into the Air Force's way of security police. At the time, it was called security police. And the career field was broken into two pieces, law enforcement and security. Security would be similar to what I did in the Army National Guard, where they were out in the field and defending the perimeter. What we were at Hanscom was a law enforcement, so we did law enforcement duties, escorts, fund escorts, protection of the inner perimeter. That's what our primary responsibility. We were also responsible for security at air shows, just pretty much anything. And
right,
that was like a normal policeman in a civilian world.
Right, so that's the broader role. And I think you told me that you did this initial assignment, or this initial unit, from like 82 to 94.
Right, approximately that time.
Or so.
I was, I initially started out as, they assigned me as a training NCO, non-commissioned officer, and I carried the same rank over as a tech sergeant again.
Right, right. And so, and you were involved, I guess, in all the military, the security police roles.
Yes, so we were involved in VIP escorts, where we would have senior senators and representatives, even the Vice President of the United States. They would fly in, and we'd provide security for their aircraft as well as escorts on the installation, along with the Massachusetts State Police and OSI.
Office of
Special Investigations.
Special Investigations, right. And during this time with the Security Police Squadron, you made significant advances in your own grades, your own promotions.
Well, one of the
Tell
things,
us a little about that.
One of the things about being in a training NCO, we were to develop training scenarios. Because I'd had training 3 years in Special Forces and 3 years in the military police out in the field, they asked me to develop a training program to take the unit out to the field to work off the base installation. So I set that all up and wound up escorting the convoy out to Sudbury, and they set up operations just as if the entire base was activated and everything that went around it. And from that point on, I was served as an aggressor to attack the perimeter so that we could test their preparations. Apparently it worked out so well that they decided to submit me for an outstanding unit, outstanding NCO of the year for for the Air Force Reserve. So I won at the local level. Then they sent me up to the command level at Wright-Patt. And finally, I went forward to Air Force board. And lo and behold, I was selected Outstanding Security Police NCO for Air Force Reserve worldwide.
Wow. Good for you.
It got me by surprise.
That's a to say the least, that's a significant. And I think you said that came relatively, that was in 83.
Right.
So not long after you, I mean, early on in your tenure.
My first year, yes.
Your first year. And over the next 12 years or so, I mean, you at that point, you were a tech sergeant?
Yes.
And tell us a little bit about your sort of promotional path over the next, over the time in that, in security forces.
I was placed in a master sergeant position, one grade above me, and they kind of trained me to assume the responsibilities of a master sergeant. So, because I had been an E6 for so long, I had time in service, time in grade, that when the minimum time came about to be promoted, I was promoted to master sergeant, which was actually my original goal. Because during the Second War, World War, my father was a master sergeant, and I said I'd like to at least do what he did. So he was a master sergeant and a first sergeant.
And your father, just to step back a minute, your father was in which branch of the service?
He was in the Army.
He was in the Army. And I think you also told me, a little bit out of place here, but you had other relatives who were also in the service.
During the Second World War, my uncle was in the Marine Corps. And during Korea, my other uncle was in the Army.
A tradition, a great military tradition in your family.
Yeah, I had a lot of people in front of me that already did it, but I think I didn't do it necessarily because of the history of all the people in my family. I did it because I felt I owed the country something growing up here, and I wanted to serve my country and do my part. I didn't want to be a shirker.
Well, you did your part and then some, I would say. But you didn't stop at Master Sergeant.
No. They at that time they had a requirement to for an operations officer. By that time, I had already had my bachelor's degree in engineering management, so that allowed me to at least apply for a reserve officer's position in security police. And first time I went up for the board, they said, well, you're 3 months too old, but we're going to ask for a waiver. I said, okay. And the three-star general from our command was going to attach a recommendation letter, which generally would hold a lot of weight. Unfortunately, something happened. My letter didn't go in with my package, so they kicked it out. Hmm. And I said, okay, well, I'll just stick in here, try to get promoted eventually to E9 chief, and that's it. They said, no, we want you to try again. So we reapplied again, and now I was a year and 3 months too old, and but this time they had a one-star, a two-star, and a three-star recommendation went with it, and lo and behold, I got the commission. So I went from a master sergeant down to a second lieutenant, starting all over again.
Starting in the officer ranks.
That's
now.
Correct.
Wow. Well, you must have, that must have been a great day.
It was great, it was different. I think it was advantageous for me to have been enlisted. I basically had 16 years enlisted time, and it really gave me a different perspective as an officer, because I'd been there, done that, and as an officer, my philosophy always was, I need you, enlisted people, more than you need me. So I'm going to do everything I can to give you whatever you need to do your job. And that's how my philosophy, and that's why I got along with enlisted people in my whole career.
And you didn't stop at second lieutenant?
No, I was placed in, when I was a second lieutenant, I was placed in a captain's position, which meant that the minimum of time of grade and service, I could be promoted to the next grade. So two more years went by, then I became a first lieutenant. A couple more years went by, then I made it to captain.
And all during this time, in this individual mobilization augmentee, you were filling a role of an active duty officer.
Correct. As a matter of fact, at one point, the active duty security police commander had to go TDY for 3 weeks, and they assigned me and they put me on active duty as the commander of the unit. Huh. I went on G-series orders, which is command orders, that allows you to have all the authority of the regular active duty commander.
So this was in charge of the whole security police squadron?
That's correct.
And that commander, what was his rank?
He was a major.
At that time, you were what, a captain?
Captain.
So you were one level below.
Yes.
And of course, that successful assignment was one of the things that helped you become a major.
Absolutely.
Which you eventually did. So all during this time, you were basically augmenting in different roles.
There were so many things that came up, I can barely remember them all, but the more significant ones were when we were responsible for air shows. They were doing it on an annual basis, and we were responsible. So I was had the responsibility as the primary point of contact for all security operations, which including parking of vehicles, securing of all the aircraft, flight line security, crowd control. So that was my responsibility, and all the people fell underneath me.
And in 1988, I know because you told me, you received the Air Force Commendation Medal for something special regarding an air show somewhere. Would you tell us about that?
We got the reputation of being really excellent with protecting and managing the security force operations for air shows. For the first time, we were the first IMA security police to get deployed overseas, and we went to Ramstein Air Base in Germany. They flew us from here to Dover, and from Dover over to Ramstein on a C-5. We went there because they wanted to have additional experienced security police to augment their force. Ramstein was a gigantic base with two separate flight lines, so it turned out to be a big challenge.
And so how long were you at Ramstein?
We were at Ramstein for 2 weeks. And we came in a week ahead of time to get oriented with the installation, and we also did town patrol in Kaiserslautern with the German police as well.
And tell us about the climax.
The climax was something you didn't really expect. Nobody expects there to be any disaster at an air show, but this was unfortunately what happened in our case. I was responsible for the security police on the immediate flight line for crowd control to ensure that nobody got anywhere near the flight lines when the aircraft were taking off. But at that time, there were also threats from the IRA, the Irish Republican Army, on British aircraft static displays, as well as the ones participating in the air show. This was a NATO air show, so there were representatives from all teams in all of the NATO countries. The United States was there, Germany, Great Britain flew, Italians, a little bit of everybody came and flew at the show. Well, we were at the end of the day with about 20 minutes left of the show, and the final demonstration team, which was supposed to be the feature, was the Italian demonstration team. Unfortunately, what had happened when conducting a particular maneuver that was heart-shaped, there were two aircraft that were supposed to crisscross across the center, similar to an arrow being shot through Cupid's heart. And unfortunately, those two planes collided. They collided and exploded in the air, and they spewed shrapnel all the way into the crowd, as well as a giant gas cloud from the igniting gasoline that hit the crowd. So at the end of the event, we wound up with 74 dead. There were people in the crowd that were burnt black, dead, died as they fell. We had one of my senior NCOs was talking to a civilian person, and he he got a piece of shrapnel into this civilian and it severed his arm, and the guy went down dead. Another case where we had a woman who was pregnant about 8 months, and she got a piece of shrapnel, sliced her open with the baby out. Another one was a lady got a piece of shrapnel, severed the top of her head, and her brain was sitting next to her body. We had one case where a young child was blown off underneath and crushed under a truck. We had some people, I had one person that looked like he was walking down the flight line with a shredded cowboy jacket. Turned out the shreds was his skin hanging off of him. Firefighter was trying to dig into the ground with his hands to bury a body because it was so horrific for him. And eventually we managed to control the crowd. Unfortunately, they didn't have enough body bags, nor did they have rubber gloves, so we had to handle all the body parts and collect them with bare hands. And it was a pretty traumatic day. I was responsible as the senior officer. I was a first lieutenant then, of ensuring we had an entry control point so that people would come in and pick up their privately owned vehicles to drive off the base. And we were also there to protect people who might have been trying to take pocketbooks or cameras or watches. So we got that done. That was about 20 minutes of five. Around 7:30, we cleaned the area up. All of the bodies were prepped and taken care of. We brought a flatbed truck out, lined them up, and took it to a makeshift morgue. The next day, we were also responsible for keeping the press from coming in and taking any gory pictures. The next day, they decided that, but one of my guys started poking fun. They said, "You're a movie star." I said, "What are you talking about, a movie star? Well, look at this." They had printed the next day Stars and Stripes, and I was on the front cover of Stars and Stripes with a couple of people as we were taking somebody away on a stretcher. So I guess that was my 1 minute of fame in the world, being on the front of Stars and Stripes. So some of our people had some breakdowns the middle of the day. My kind of breakdown came a couple of weeks later when I just was driving and I started getting tears in my eyes and I had to pull over. So,
and you were back home by that time?
Yes. It was the last day just before we were going to leave.
Wow. So, well, that was I remember that incident. Anybody who was around, it was worldwide attention, certainly.
Well, anybody here that has served in any kind of an area where a disaster or combat, you can definitely recognize the smell of burning flesh. You don't forget it.
Well, so that was in 1988.
That's correct.
I see, and you were still in your responsibilities, increasing responsibilities with the security police.
Right, at the time I was operations officer.
Were you a first lieutenant at that time?
First lieutenant, yeah.
Okay. And so you just progressed to Captain. AMI for the operations and then eventually to the whole squadron.
Right.
As you increased in rank.
Right, and I eventually, for the next rank, they had to put me in a position as the IMA to the commander. So if he wasn't there, they called me in and I served in his role until he got back. And that was my responsibility.
Right.
And then that put me in a major's position. And when that happened, in order to get promoted, besides time and grade, you need to conduct and take the required training. So I went to squadron officer school and then eventually went to Air Command and Staff College. So that was my progression in.
And at some point in there, you shifted from the security police to a broader role.
Rice, what happened is when I was a major, I effectively had no further area to go into in security police. If it had been a security police group, there probably would have been a lieutenant commander billet, but I'm a lieutenant colonel billet, but I didn't have that here. So there, in order for me to continue my career, the senior IMAs of the installation decided that they would give me an opportunity to step out of security police and do something different. So I was given the opportunity to become the IMA to the support group commander, who was a major.
And what was a support group?
A support group is all of the functional organizations in the Air Force and installation. It consisted of security, police, electronics, civil engineering, munitions. Everything fell under there.
So the security police that you'd come from was one unit within this broader.
Yes.
Essentially, Hanscom is a big base with lots of functions. It's got people living on it, right? Barracks, PX, etc. So there's lots of support functions.
That's correct.
And that support group was responsible for all of them.
For all of them, yes.
And so you were IMA to the support group commander.
That's right.
As a major initially.
Major. Yes.
And then you were promoted further.
Yes, we went to once we changed the configuration of the installation, it became a mission support group, and that was headed by a lieutenant colonel. So they put me in a lieutenant colonel position to serve as his IMA. So again, I had to do Air Command and Staff College, which allowed me to be moved up and promoted to lieutenant colonel.
So now you are continuing your steady march upward.
Upward.
With increasing responsibility, and again, you're a reservist, but
yes.
You took over these active duty roles when the active duty person was not around.
That's correct. And then after that, they once I made lieutenant colonel, I was eligible to go to Air War College, which is the prerequisite for getting promoted to full colonel.
The War College.
Right, that the Air War College for reservists is particularly difficult because it's almost a year course, and you can't get very many reservists who are willing to give up their job for a year, so they set that up as correspondence courses, and you went to the base education office where you took closed book exams to pass. Except in the case of Air War College, we had a seminar that was overseen with active duty instructors from Maxwell Air Force Base.
So ultimately you were promoted to colonel.
Correct.
In about when? 2002 or 3?
Around there, yes.
And at that point, what job did you move into?
Well, they moved me from, as the mission support group commander, there was a 3-month pay gap in the being able to get a replacement. So for 3 months, I was put again on active duty and on G-series command orders as the mission support group commander for Hanscom Air Force Base.
So this was 3 months of active duty?
Yes.
So what about your civilian job?
Well, there wasn't that much they could say about it. They just had to do it.
So you just put that on pause.
That's right.
And went back to it after?
After I was done, right. And that was an interesting position because, again, I was in command of all these support units underneath. And that was another growing experience which just expanded my knowledge of Air Force operations. Every time I got a promotion, it was a case of going up, looked toward the higher level, and seeing the broader picture.
Right.
And because I had done so much prep work, and I always made sure that all my training was done ahead of time, I never missed a promotion. I always got promoted the first time.
And so you got promoted to colonel.
Correct.
And what, was there yet another level of responsibility for you?
Yes, yes, as a matter of fact. Now I was the IMA to the Air Base Wing Commander. So if the Air Base Wing Commander wasn't there, then I would take in his position.
And what is the Air Base Wing Commander?
He's a full colonel in charge of the entire installation.
In charge of what?
The entire installation.
The entire Hanscom Air Force Base.
Yeah, over 10,000 people.
10,000 people?
Yeah. Because it also included responsibility for the civilians as well as the military.
So there were periods, and this was like a seven-year period or
yes.
so
yeah.
before you eventually retired when
right.
you were in this role.
Right.
So there were times when you were the acting, what'd they call it, acting base wing commander?
Yeah. I would just come in, and they'd say wing commander was going to be on leave for a week. I was the guy that came in, took his place, answered the questions, passed out whatever requirements had to be addressed, and just did what I had to do.
What were some of the things, I mean, that come to mind in either of these last two roles that you'd like to tell us about, your own memorable experiences?
There's so many. However, one of the things I found extremely interesting as a full colonel, I was put on as the alternate magistrate for a magistrate court and any punitive actions that had to be addressed. So I actually got to be the colonel in charge of a court-martial board when we had, I got to listen to a defense attorney and a prosecuting attorney based on a case. And then after I had listened to that, I adjourned to a separate room to talk with what my options were for punishment for the offender with the JAG people, and I dropped the hammer. I was never afraid to be a person that had to do the hard job or the hard tasks. I didn't shy away from it. I did what I had to do, and this person received the punishment that he deserved, and that was just one thing. I didn't think twice about it because that was my job. We had cases where I had to have people escorted off the base. We found out someone was a pedophile sex offender and a dependent of someone on the installation. So I went out there with a notice from the installation commander for me to have him escorted off the installation. He was a minor, so that means his dependent father had to take him, and I went there, read the order, security police was with me, and so was the JAG, and father said, how much time do we have to prep, because he was about 15, and I said, about as much time as you have to pack his bag, and that was the order given to me. Again, didn't think twice about it, it was my job, I did what I had to do. So very often I was put in positions of doing tasks that may have been distasteful for other people, but didn't really bother me.
Your job.
I did my job. We had cases where I would run operations called Nighthawk, and that was an operation to check people coming on the installation for drug use or being impaired driving. And we would have representatives from the clinic, security police, and JAG to have these people pulled over. And the security police would ask them to exit their vehicles. If they appeared to be impaired, then they would send them over to the next building where they would be subjected to urinalysis or blood test. And if they were found to be inebriated or high from drugs, then they were in real trouble as far as their career went.
Might be useful at this point if you could broadly describe what the mission of Hanscom Air Force Base is, main mission.
Main mission of Hanscom, they're a research and development center for advanced weapon systems for the Air Force. So majority, we didn't have an active flight line with active aircraft on it. We were, as I said, research and develop. We would have active duty aircraft transit in to Hanscom Air Force Base, whether it be via IP escort or other aircraft assigned to some of the subordinate electronic systems areas, in which case they would be testing all the brand new equipment, basically point of the spear type of technology.
Right.
They worked in conjunction.
A very specialized base, to be sure.
It was, definitely.
I have to add here, Nick probably wouldn't add this himself, but during the course, probably the last 10 years of your time at Hanscom, you were awarded 3 Meritorious Service Medals.
Oh, well, it was actually longer than that, because each medal is it takes about 3 to 5 years to have accumulated enough to warrant a Meritorious Service Medal. But yes, I did. I received.
But these medals, this is a high level of award. Well, they certainly aren't awarded to everybody for time served.
No.
Indicative of you going above and beyond in all that you did.
Well, it includes things that you accomplished that were of significance during that period of time. So fortunately, I mean, I was just blessed that they trusted me and gave me things to really do that I could get my teeth into that made a difference, and that gave me a lot of pride in what I was able to accomplish. Sometimes I was in charge of the Juvenile Control Board, which we'd had. Sometimes children would stray off the path and be vandals or cause things like that. It was my responsibility to talk to the parents, talk to the child, and mete out some kind of punishment to them, whether it be community service or writing me an essay as to why do you understand what you did and what you're not going to do. And it was good, and I could be afford to be, I guess for a better word, merciful for them, because it was important that we not destroy the child and, you know, really penalize him heavily. And it was also important not to impact the career of the active duty parents. So
yes.
I would have an austere face on, and because I spoke to the parents ahead of time and tell them what I would do, and then I would make them seriously remember what their responsibilities are and how their actions could impact their parents' career. So that was very rewarding. I really enjoyed working with the children.
So in 2009, nearly 40 years after you began, it was time to wind up your career.
Right. I was not going to go any higher. If I had possibly gotten my commission the first time, I was just too far. I could have had a shot at a one-star slot, but I was just too old. And that's okay. I have no regrets. Quite frankly, I think being a full colonel is a lot of fun, because you get to get your hands dirty and do things that maybe a general wouldn't be able to do. So I was blessed to have made it that high, considering I started off as an airman basic and go all the way up. I got to see a lot of things and do a lot of things.
There just can't be many folks who've gone from E1 to O6.
No, I think the term they call us Mustangs.
Mustangs, right.
Because we crossed over. They said you would be an enlisted man, and then you crossed over to the dark side as an officer.
Well, I'm sure a lot of enlisted men didn't think you were on the dark side. Sounds like you knew where they were coming from, too.
It was, and that was one of the pleasurable things. I think it's important that, for me, that I spent that amount of time and learning what I liked and what I didn't like, so that as an officer I could make sure those type of situations weren't there for the enlisted force. As I said, I needed them more than they needed me. My job was to make sure that they had everything they need, whether it be clothes, equipment, food, shelter. That was my job.
Well, congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
And this is taking a different tack, but I have to talk about this briefly.
Okay.
You are of Greek heritage.
That's correct.
I don't know how many generations back came from Greece.
My grandparents came from Greece.
They came from Greece. But what I do know is that you've been all through this time as part of your non-military life, among many things that you've done, you're very active in affairs relating to Greece.
Right.
And furthermore, you are a musician, you've had a band, and you played a very special instrument. What was it?
I played a Greek folk instrument called a bouzouki, and it's a folk instrument, and it's primarily designed to play folk music. When I was 16 years old, I was very fortunate to have the opportunity to go to Greece with some people, and I lived in a village for 3 months. That in itself was an eye-opener, because it was like stepping back in a time capsule 100 years. I still lived in a village where there was no running water. You had to crank water from a well. We had no showers or bathtubs. You went and swam in the river with a bar of soap. We had no toilets. We had an outhouse that you had to use. So there was no air conditioning. The electricity was on only a few hours a day. There were no refrigerators. There were no tarred roads. People got around either on little motor scooters or by horse or drove wagons around. It was an experience. Because there was very little food to eat, I wound up losing 41 pounds in 3 months.
Wow.
But I worked out in the fields with them. It was just a wonderful experience. Came back and made me appreciate what I had back here in the United States.
But it also made you appreciate your Greek heritage.
Absolutely. It was after that I decided I wanted to do a little more. So I decided I wanted to play music. So I started learning the instrument by myself. My friend brought me a bouzouki from Greece, and I just started learning. And I would follow the orchestras around and ask them, the bouzouki player, if he would just give me a few tips and hints. And then nobody refused. And I wound up playing for years, as I say, 55 years, made a recording. I've played in Greece about 8 or 9 times. It was a lot of fun.
And you became probably a master bouzouki player.
I was a very good bouzouki player. I wasn't a master.
Okay.
I'll keep
but
it
now I happen to know, I think I know, but I'm going to let you complete the story. I saw something on the internet about an instrument of yours that's now in a favorite place of mine, which is the Museum of Fine Arts, Boston.
Oh, a couple of instruments. I'd collected instruments. Every time, we went to Greece about a dozen times, my wife and I, we took my daughter 5 times as she was growing up, and I would seek out these traditional instruments, the techniques of where, and the people who built them were dying, and the younger people weren't picking up the mantle to continue. So I would take some of these instruments. So a few of them, yes, I actually, they're in the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, and I'm very proud to say that it came from me.
Well, you do get credit because I saw it. So congratulations. Just another dimension of Nick Zalas. Kind of wrap up here, Nick, back to your military service. How important to you was serving in the military? How do you think it affected your life?
Well, it's certainly the discipline that the military taught me, helped me my entire life. If it wasn't for that, I never would have had an associate's degree, 2 bachelor's degrees, and 2 master's degrees. It just kept me, gave me the motivation, and taught me a lot of self-confidence. Because if you can go through all these trainings, schools, basic training, you should be able to do almost anything. And it sort of improved my confidence. As a matter of fact, my daughter credits me with being disciplined enough to teach her to be disciplined so that she could complete the rigorous regimen of becoming a veterinarian. So I'm very proud of that. I was able to help her. And she said I helped her to be disciplined enough. And so as far as the impact for me, I'm proud to be an American. and I'm proud to have served in the military forces because I love my country and I love being in the military. And even after that, I still wouldn't let go. After I retired, I worked as a government civil service for the military as the Hanscom Air Force Base anti-terrorism officer. So I never left at all. I just kept going and on and on. And I just really love it.
It was your life.
It was my life, and it's been a lot of water under the bridge, and it's been really great. I have thousands of memories, and some of them I can't remember, but it was great being both in the Army and the Air Force.
So looking back, is there one memorable experience or character or humorous experience? You've shared a lot with us, but sort of to sum up.
Well, I think the biggest point was, I thought most importantly, and it seemed to be a policy that helped me, whenever I went forward to be given an opportunity for promotion, and for example, if I was selected to be the support group commander, they would interview a half a dozen people, not just me. And the first thing I would say to the commander says, "Sir, what can I do for you to make your job easier as opposed to what can you do for me?" And I think that impressed them enough that they said, "Man's willing to do what he has to do without expecting anything in return." And I never did, but it just showed with that attitude and spirit and drive, I was always, the people liked me and always pushed me forward. And I never failed in every promotional opportunity. So it was really good.
A philosophy that served you well throughout.
And I think part of the issue was, with my father dying so young, I was forced to grow up by myself. And I learned a lot of hard lessons and people took advantage of me. And I became street smart. And I think that helps you an awful lot in the service.
I'm sure it certainly helped you. Thank you for all you did for your country.
Oh, thank you very much for asking me to be participating in this particular event. I appreciate it.
Is there anything else that you'd like to say that we haven't asked you? We've covered a lot of ground, but...
Well, I thought one unusual, when I went to Air Base Griffin, the Ground Defense School, I came from that small town of Webster, which is kind of southwest of Worcester. And one day we were going out to the field. We had a female staff sergeant driving the truck. And so I just kind of talked, chatting with her. I said, "Where are you from?" She says, "Massachusetts." I said, "So am I." I said, "What town?" She says, "You probably wouldn't know it. It's a little town." I said, "What's the name of it?" She said, "Webster." I said, "Webster?" I says, "I was born in Webster." And I said, "What school did you go to?" Turned out that she happened to be from the parochial school, and I was in the public school, and we were the same age. So it's a small world. Here I am at Bergstrom Air Force Base in Texas, and I meet a female Air Force member who was from the same town as me in the same. Who knows if we hadn't bumped into ourselves decades earlier? So I thought that was kind of interesting.
Well, thank you for that. And Nick, I just say thank you, Nicholas Michael Zales, for your great participation in this program.
Thank you, and quite frankly, all of this wouldn't have been possible without the support of my wife all these years, as well as my daughter. And they were always there to help me and support me. In fact, my daughter often used to shine my boots for me to save me the time. So I've been blessed.
Thank you again.
Thank you very much.